Call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is Wednesday, March 25th. We don't have a lot of items to get through, but we have a lot of people that want to talk about just a few items. So we're going to try to keep moving right along today. We're going to start out with an informational meeting with some invited testimony, a couple of presentations, one from the Department of Environmental Quality and one from the PUC on reducing carbon emissions through energy policy. Then we're going to move into a public hearing on Senate Bill 477. So with that, I'm going to open up the informational meeting, reducing carbon emissions through energy policy. And if the aforementioned departments slash commissions could come forward. I'll just let you jump right in. I don't care who goes first.
All right. Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. Thank you for your time this afternoon. For the record, my name is Colin McConaughey with the Department of Environmental Quality, and I'm going to start off today by giving a brief description of EPA's Clean Power Plan, otherwise known as 111D. This is the EPA's proposed federal regulations of coal and natural gas power plants to reduce CO2 emissions from those facilities. EPA's Clean Power Plan proposal is perhaps one of the most significant efforts under the Obama administration to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Again, it targets those carbon emissions from coal and natural gas power plants, and the current proposal would reduce those emissions by approximately 30% by 2030. Coal and natural gas power plants happen to be the largest point source of greenhouse gas emissions within the United States, comprising approximately one-third of total domestic greenhouse gas emissions. And EPA is proposing this federal rule under their authority of Section 111D of the Clean Air Act. So before I begin to describe EPA's proposal, I'll just give you a quick rundown here of the timeline. EPA proposed this rule last year in June, and they now expect to issue their final rule later this summer. Initially, they have targeted June of this year, but we understand they have delayed it by 1 to 2 months, so we expect it later in the summer of this year. Whenever EPA does issue their final rule, we understand states will have at least 1 year to develop and submit our state plans to implement the federal rule, with an opportunity to extend, to get a one-year extension should we need new legislation to enforce our state plan, or a two-year extension if we are coordinating our state plan with other states' plans. So I'll begin by describing the process that EPA is using to issue the Clean Power Plan. Much of the process at the outset is dictated by Section 111D of the Clean Air Act. Section 111D directs EPA to develop a uniform national emission guideline based on what it refers to as the best system of emission reductions. And it further defines that as comprising all adequately demonstrated measures to reduce the targeted pollutant from the facilities in question. So in this case, EPA starts out by developing, a uniform national emission guideline based on all adequately demonstrated measures to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from coal and natural gas power plants. Once EPA has developed that emission guideline, they then apply it to each state separately. And because in this case, the power sectors within each state differ, and differ sometimes significantly, the application of this emission guideline, although it's a single national guideline, the application of it to each state separately produces distinct state-specific emission reduction targets. In this case, the emission reduction targets are expressed as an emission rate. I'll explain a little bit more about that in the next slide, but it is an emission rate of carbon dioxide per megawatt hour of generation. After EPA has developed this emission guideline and applied it to each state, states are then given a period of time, again, at least a year, to develop state plans to achieve that emission reduction. 111D affords states a fairly high degree of flexibility in determining what we as states prefer to do in order to achieve that emission reduction goal. And EPA appears to be embracing that element of 111D by giving states significant amounts of flexibility, at least in their proposal. Once states develop our state implementation plans, we then submit them to EPA for review. And after they have approved it, we begin implementing the elements of our state plan. EPA, in this case, anticipates that compliance with those state plans would begin in 2020, and states would achieve the ultimate emission goals by 2030. So I'll get now describe what is probably the most important part of their proposal, which is how they constructed this emission guideline that they're using in their proposal. And EPA determined that all adequately demonstrated measures to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from coal and natural gas facilities can be lumped into four areas, or building blocks, as they refer to them. And I'll walk you through each of these four building blocks. And they apply, again, these are the blocks are the same, but their application in each state differs because of the different power sector characteristics within each state. So I'll start here at the left. The first building block within EPA's emission guideline includes all emission reductions that could be reasonably achieved by improving the operations at a coal facility, so making it operate a little bit more efficiently and emitting a little less CO2 per unit of generation. The second building block looks at the amount of emission reductions that could be achieved by shifting from coal generation to existing natural gas generation within the state. So a state that has quite a lot of both, quite a lot of coal and natural gas generation both, may have some significant emission reductions that could be achieved by shifting generation at those coal facilities to greater reliance on the natural gas facilities. I should note that natural gas emits about half as much CO2 as coal does per unit of generation. The third building block in EPA's emission guideline includes the emission reductions that can be achieved by investing in renewable energy or otherwise non-emitting sources of generation. And then finally, the fourth building block includes the emission reductions that can be achieved by reducing the overall demand in the electricity sector and thereby reducing demand on those natural gas and coal power plants. So EPA determines the amount of emission reductions that can be achieved within each of these four blocks in a given state, adds those emission reductions up, and that produces a state's emission rate target, again, as expressed as pounds of carbon dioxide per megawatt hour. And for Oregon, there at the bottom of the slide, you'll now see the application of those four building blocks, as EPA proposes, results in a 48% emission reduction by 2030. EPA used 2012 data to characterize states' starting conditions, and in Oregon in that year, using EPA's data, we emitted on average 717 pounds of carbon dioxide per megawatt hour generated within our state. Again, applying those four building blocks lowers the average emission rate 48% down to 372 pounds per megawatt hour. That's the target. If the proposal was final today, that's the average emission rate we as a state would need to hit by 2030. So I want to briefly draw some parallels between those building blocks and policies we have here in the state already. I think Jason's going to describe these in more detail, but it's worth noting that there is a lot of connection here between what we're already doing in Oregon and what EPA is contemplating to include in their emission guideline. I'll skip block one because block two for Oregon effectively wipes out any effect that block one would have. Again, block one is the includes emission reductions from improvements at coal power plants, and then block two looks at emission reductions that can occur from shifting away from coal and relying more on gas generation. In the case of Oregon and the way EPA has developed block two, they say that all the generation at Oregon's one coal plant in Boardman could be shifted onto existing natural gas power plants throughout our state. In our case, we of course already have an agreement with PGE to stop coal operations anyway at Boardman by the end of 2020. So we're already on track to achieve the emission reductions envisioned by block two.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
If I may interject. My understanding was that Boardman wasn't going to be counted.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I think Boardman is included in the proposal. It is certainly embedded in the existing emission rates that I just mentioned in the previous slide, as well as seven, I believe, other natural gas-fired power plants.
I understand that.
So for clarification, it's included in 717?
Correct.
It's included in the...
And will we get credit for
yes.
closing it on our way to three, whatever
yes.
the number was?
Yeah. Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, absolutely. We would get credit. Again, as the proposal exists today, for closing or ceasing coal operations at Boardman.
We had discussions on this back in Washington, and they said because we decided to close Boardman before 2012, it wouldn't count towards the reduction. Could you send me any information you have on that?
I can, absolutely.
Thank you.
Good question.
Question, yeah.
Again, real briefly here, just a couple more parallels between what we have here in Oregon and the building blocks in EPA's guideline. Block three of their guideline envisions emission reductions coming from renewable energy. We, of course, already have a statewide renewable portfolio standard that requires increasing amounts of renewable energy acquisition by our state's largest utilities. And then finally, building block four, emission reductions that can be accrued from energy efficiency. Oregon happens to be a national leader in the acquisition of energy efficiency, largely through investments from PGE and PacifiCo ratepayers that fund the Energy Trust of Oregon, as well as ratepayers in our public utilities that fund energy efficiency investments from the Bonneville Power Administration. So again, just some parallels there, that we don't have any numbers to speak to what business as usual would look like compared to the ultimate target that EPA envisions, in part because of some significant questions that still remain. I'll touch on a couple of those here in the next few slides. But just again, there are quite a lot of some significant parallels between existing policies and what EPA is envisioning in their proposal. So transitioning now to some to describe some comments that Oregon agencies have already provided to EPA. DEQ, in concert with the Oregon Department of Energy, as well as the Public Utility Commission, jointly developed a letter to EPA toward the end of last year. And in the letter, we expressed broad support for EPA's endeavor to produce a national greenhouse gas regulation for the energy sector, as well as more specific support for them defining the emission reductions possible quite broadly to include reductions possible from renewable energy and energy efficiency. We do, however, in our letter, devote most of the space to providing specific recommendations on clarifications or changes that we would like to see EPA make in the final rule. And I'll describe a couple of the more significant recommendations we make in the next couple of slides regarding renewable energy and energy efficiency. First, I'll describe the main recommendation we make concerning renewable energy is that EPA allow states to take credit for renewable energy based on the amount of renewable energy they are consuming within the state, not necessarily the amount of generation that occurs within the state's jurisdictional boundaries. And we think there's a few different important advantages to crediting renewable energy based on consumption, chiefly that it as a policy mechanism, it properly incentivizes the investment in renewable energy by crediting those utilities and the ratepayers that are investing in renewable energy. And secondly, it can leverage existing tracking systems that are already in place in the western United States and elsewhere that track renewable energy based on where it's consumed. And finally, we think it also helps to encourage existing forms of renewable energy policy like a renewable portfolio standard. Piece of input that we provided to EPA, and probably the most significant in our letter, concerns how EPA would allow states to credit energy efficiency. In this case, we ask EPA to consider changing changing in the final rule what they proposed in June. In this case, EPA envisioned or proposes that that states would get credit for energy efficiency based on only on the effects of the energy efficiency they invest in that reduce emissions within that state's borders. For a state like Oregon that imports significant amounts of fossil-generated electricity, that would mean we would get pennies on the dollar for our investments in energy efficiency, and we don't think that's an intended consequence for EPA's rule by effectively disincentivizing investments in energy efficiency. So we ask that EPA consider changing how energy efficiency would be credited to states by allowing states to credit the full range of emission reductions that arise from their energy efficiency investments, including emission reductions that occur outside of the state. And again, that mirrors the rationale for our recommendation for renewable energy, in that we think that provides a more suitable policy mechanism to incentivize investments in energy efficiency. So lastly, I'll just conclude here with a few next steps that we anticipate concerning EPA's Clean Power Plan. We expect to continue to work together as agencies to understand what EPA's proposal would mean for our state and our different compliance options, and to work with stakeholders to consider the various compliance options leading up to the final rule that we expect EPA to publish later this summer. Once they do that, that will then begin in earnest developing our state plan and working with stakeholders. And ultimately, the state plan, at the very least, will need to be to go through a rulemaking process through our Environmental Quality Commission, but it very well may require other rulemakings and approvals from other state agencies and possibly new legislation if we need new authority to enforce the various mechanisms that we decide we want to include in our state plan. And with that, I can either take questions now or we can move on to Jason and take whole questions till the end.
Does anybody have questions specific to this part
before
we move on?
What is the reduction required of Washington?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I believe it is 71%. So I think Washington received the highest reduction target of any state. I actually have the numbers.
Utah?
It's almost 72%.
How about Utah? Do you have that?
I do, 27%.
So a state without generation gets 48% reduction, and a state with coal generation gets 27% reduction. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so just, you know, a comment, and thank you for this presentation, Colin. We heard this in this committee back in December, just right after you had submitted the letter, I think, to the EPA. And you know, one of the provisions that we've heard about in the plan does allow for some cooperative strategies among states in meeting their targets. And at that time, it still wasn't clear where EPA was going with that. Do we know any more about that? And before you answer that, you know, I also, you know, with respect to what Senator Olson asked about, you know, this discrepancy in, you know, the percentages, you know, I would say that even though our requirement is higher than Utah, I think a lot of people believe that it's going to be easier for us to meet that target than Utah because of all the sort of heavy political lifting that we've done to get to this point, you know, the decision to close Boardman, the various, you know, the RPS, a number of things are going to help us to bring down those percentages, arguably much easier than Utah will.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson, you had an answer, and then we'll go to Senator Thompson.
Sorry. Chair Edwards, Senator Dimbro, thank you. We don't have any new specific information directly from EPA about what they may or may not allow concerning multi-state collaboration. I was up here at the end of last year in front of the interim committee, I don't believe there has been any new information from EPA officially regarding that. There's certainly been a lot more conversation amongst states about how we might work together, and that continues.
Senator Thompson,
how much credit do we get out here in Oregon for and Washington get or whatever for the hydroelectricity we generate from the dams on the Columbia?
Jared,
that's as clean as energy as you can get. So, how much credit do we get for that,
Senator Thompson? We don't get credit explicitly for the hydroelectric system. EPA. In looking at renewables for that block three of their emission guideline, looks at new renewable generation. So we certainly, by virtue of having a great deal of hydroelectric infrastructure in place, were we to make efficiency improvements to those, and that happens occasionally, that incremental amount of additional hydroelectric generation, that efficiency improvement or other change to the generation, that would count. But the existing stuff that is the existing generation that is there today does not count directly toward our goal.
Can you go back to the time where that why doesn't that count? Was there a law passed in the state that said we couldn't count that? Was there federal legislation that says you can't count hydro? Hydro, unless it's new hydro. I mean, it's the cleanest energy in the world. Why can't we count it? Why don't we get credit for it?
I think, Senator Thompson, I think the most direct answer to that is no, there's nothing in our state legislation that prohibits EPA from allowing us to count that. I believe that what you're seeing there is a product of EPA's authority under the Clean Air Act, which in this case gives them authority to seek measures to reduce emissions at coal and natural gas power plants. So to the extent that we have coal and natural gas in Oregon and serving Oregonians today, even though we have all of that hydroelectric generation going on, EPA is now in a position where they have to say, look at a state like Oregon and say, okay, what measures does Oregon have to further reduce the emissions at the coal and natural gas within their borders? So one measure to do that would be to expand further on our hydroelectric system, but they don't, they are not able to, under their authority of the Clean Air Act, to explicitly credit into the system existing hydroelectric the way you're describing.
Other questions? Mm-hmm. Okay. Jason? Thanks, Colin.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee. Wait for this guy. I'm Jason Eisdorfer, Program Director of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. We're going to, in the next nine slides, going to walk through some of the existing policies in the state of Oregon that are either directly or indirectly aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We're going to talk a little bit about the policy and rate making that the commission has in general, and then we're going to go outside the state and look at some of the policies that other states have adopted that Oregon doesn't have in within our borders. And before I start, there are sort of four very quick points. One is that when we talk about through energy policy, we're talking about stationary energy policy, not transportation energy policy. Because there's quite a bit going on, this is a very high review. We're happy to go into detail in questions, but I'm just going to hit them and move on. Some of these policies specifically target greenhouse gas reductions. Others seem to have multiple benefits, and greenhouse gas reduction is one of those several benefits. And then finally, some of these policies will apply to investor-owned, some will apply to consumer-owned, and then some will apply to both. So the first slide is actually not the state. It's the federal policies. I just want to throw this up here. There are lots and lots of federal policies that are looking to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. These are ones largely under the Clean Air Act relating specifically to coal generation. Colin mentioned that coal generation is a primary source of carbon pollution. And Colin focused in on the bottom bullet, the 111D, but it's worth noting here that regional haze and mercury air toxic standards are currently being implemented by the EPA under the Clean Air Act, and those rules and regulations apply a little bit differently to differently situated coal combustion units. Pacific Corp, for example, has a number of coal units in its fleet, and they are currently dealing with and trying to respond to these EPA clean air regs under the first couple of bullets. Okay, so this is the first of two slides on the major Oregon policies. Again, I'm going to sort of hit the high points here. House Bill 3543 in 2007 set aspirational goals for the state to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. You can see those numbers up there. That same bill created the Global Warming Commission, which every couple of years delivers to the legislature a report on how we're doing in terms of meeting those goals. Also, that bill sort of nominated the Oregon State Oregon Climate Change Research Institute as a primary point of climate change research. The second bullet is 3283 from 1997, and there Oregon became the first state in the country to enact an emission standard for new power plants. This is natural gas or any other plant that might emit carbon dioxide. It's operated through the Department of Energy and FSEC, and they established rules creating a pounds per megawatt hour standard. And one of the ways that a new power plant can meet that standard is to invest in offsets. So the Climate Trust was created, and the Climate Trust actually takes funding from new power plants and invests in activities that reduce carbon, for renewables, energy efficiency, other kinds of activities. The Emissions Performance Standard is Senate Bill 101. That's from 2009. That bill created an explicit pounds per megawatt hour standard at 1,100 pounds per megawatt hour, which is sort of at the inefficient end of a natural gas facility, and it's, again, about half the pounds per megawatt hour of a coal facility. And the EPS tells utilities, both consumer-owned and investor-owned, that they may not sign long-term contracts for base load with facilities that have a pounds per megawatt hour carbon profile greater than that 1,100 pounds per megawatt hour. And then the fourth bullet there is the energy efficiency. Colin mentioned this, Senate Bill 1149 from 1999 and Senate Bill 838 for 2007 identified funds for energy efficiency that for PGE and PacifiCorp are run through the Energy Trust of Oregon. And Bonneville Power Administration has a core program in its rates for consumer-owned utilities. Renewable Portfolio Standard, Senate Bill 838, also from 2007, or actually still from 2007, it applies to all utilities in the state, but it applies different standards depending upon their size. The three largest utilities in the state, PG, PacifiCorp, and UEB, have that 25% by 2025 standard. Smaller utilities either have a 5% or 10% by 2025 standard. There are a number of solar incentives in state law. You can see the net metering volumetric incentive rate that's a pilot, the solar capacity standard. So there are actually quite a number of smaller solar incentives. And Senate Bill 844 is from 2013. The Public Utility Commission has a general authority to ensure safe, reliable, and adequate service. The commission does not have the explicit authority to consider the environmental harm of resource investment. And so what 844 did was a very minor exception to that. A very minor exception to that, and it allows natural gas utilities to come in and make proposals for projects that benefit their customers but also have a specific goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And the commission can look really just in that specific instance at the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that are being reduced from those projects. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the Commission's carbon toolkit. The first and foremost is integrated resource planning. The Oregon Commission takes IRPs very seriously. This is a requirement of the three electric utilities the Commission regulates, PGE, PacifiCorp, and Idaho Power, and the three natural gas utilities, Northwest Natural, Cascade, and Avista. And the IRP is a 20-year look. They take a look at the forecasted load over that 20-year period, and they come up with a series of resource portfolios that could meet that load. And then they run those portfolios through a set of scenarios. One of those scenarios is a projected set of CO2 prices. So as if there was a carbon price imposed upon the system, either at the state level or at the federal level. And so there's frequently a low, a medium, and a high carbon scenario. And so they then run those portfolios against those carbon prices, and they determine which is the least cost and least risk way to serve customers. One of the scenarios that the commission asked the utilities to run is what would it take, what portfolio would allow the state to meet the state's greenhouse gas emission reduction goals that we talked about a little bit earlier. And then ultimately, the commission can either decide to acknowledge or not acknowledge that integrated resource plan. That becomes relevant when rate making happens. The utility will ultimately identify a 5-year action plan and actually begin to make resource decisions. Once they make those resource decisions, they'll come back to the commission and ask for rate recovery in a rate case. And one of the things that the commission will do to test the prudence of a particular resource decision is to look at the net present value of some of the alternatives. So a very specific example here is if PacifiCorp were to come and show that there was a particular Clean Air Act regulation on mercury haze and the cost of the environmental pollution control investment would be a certain amount of money to extend the life of the plant for 10 or 20 years. The commission would also like to see, well, what would be the net present value of actually shutting that coal plant down early, not making that investment, and then compare and contrast the net present value of those two actions. So here are run through a couple of examples of this. Colin mentioned the early closure of Boardman. My recollection is that the environmental pollution control investments were heading up into the hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe $500 million to extend the life of Boardman to 2040. DEQ, PUC, the PGE, and the number of stakeholders got together and did the analysis of what would it be if PGE made an investment of a fraction of that, maybe 80, 90, 100 million, just to get Boardman up to about a 2020 date and then shut it down. Those two net present values were very similar, and in fact, in a least cost, least risk basis, the parties all came together and decided that closing Boardman early was the least cost, least risk action they could take. To 2007 IRP, PacifiCorp proposed two new coal plants. This was I can't remember exactly the dollar amount, but it was billions of dollars, maybe $3 billion, something in that range, to develop two new coal plants. The commission scrubbed that one pretty hard. There were a number of issues involved with that analysis. Ultimately, the commission did not acknowledge those investments, which did create some regulatory risk for the company. The company ultimately decided not to go through building those new coal plants, and 6 months later, the market crashed. Load went down significantly, and I'm not sure Oregon gets quite the credit for saving PacifiCorp ratepayers a lot of money, but that's exactly what happened through that process.
So had they built those plants, they wouldn't have been built into Oregon rates. Is that
Chair right? Edwards, by not acknowledging that IRP, it doesn't necessarily mean the costs wouldn't come into through a rate case. It means really the burden on the company would be a little bit greater, that they didn't get sort of an early nod from the commission. So I can't say that it wouldn't go into rates, okay, but it would have been a little bit more difficult,
okay,
probably.
Okay.
I won't go through these other two. I think I'll say that the third one was a rate case situation where there were a number of environmental pollution control investments on a number of coal plants. The commission was generally not particularly pleased with the type of analysis that that the company made in the rate case stage, and the PUC did disallow a portion of the investment. So there's action to be taken at the IRP level and at the rate case level. Okay, so let's jump into other states here. So there are two operating carbon cap and trade systems going on in the U.S. at this point. One is REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. These are nine states in the Northeast. This is a cap and trade on electricity generation. Ultimately, what happens by putting the cap on it and allowing allowances to be traded as a price of carbon begins to emerge. In addition to having that price of carbon, additional revenues are created by the sale of the allowances. And according to REGI, they say that during the lifetime of the program, as you see, they anticipate the system to avoid 8 million tons of carbon dioxide. And a lot of that additional allowance revenue is funneled back into energy efficiency at the consumer level. And by virtue of that, they state that consumers will save upwards of $2 billion. California cap and trade, the AB 32, this covers not just the electricity generation, but it also recently extends into fuel distributors. So they In California, they are covering both stationary and transportation sources. It's not quite economy-wide, but it's sort of getting there. You can see it's 85% of the state's greenhouse gas emissions. And same basic theory. You cap it. You allow trading of allowances, which both sends a price signal but also generates revenue. I put a couple of Canada's carbon policies on here really for one reason, not the first bullet. Quebec's carbon market is actually pretty similar to California's in terms of its coverage, electricity sector, and stretching out into the transportation. But I just wanted to also show the British Columbia, the BC carbon price. So the BC carbon price is really trying to internalize the cost of carbon. It uses market forces to send a price signal to customers. So as a customer, if I'm comparing widgets, the widget with that is least carbon intensive ought naturally to be of a lower cost, and so I tend to make that decision. It also tends to move technology toward identifying lower carbon cost technologies precisely for this point. And then, obviously, the carbon price or the carbon tax raises revenue, and that revenue could be used the way Reggie uses the cap and trade allowance money to reinvest in renewables or energy efficiency. BC chose to basically substitute for other tax revenues, and they made the carbon price there revenue neutral. And then finally, back in the U.S., Colorado several years ago enacted what was called the Clean Air, Clean Jobs Act, and this is a comprehensive plan for the utilities some of the utilities in Colorado to begin to transition from coal to natural gas or other types of resources. And it required the PSC, the Public Service Company, to submit a plan to the commission to identify exactly how they were going to reduce carbon emissions from their coal plants over time. Something to be noticed about the Colorado plan is that all of the coal plants that fell under that law are in the state of Colorado. And they were actually responding to a number of different stresses there, one of which is a number of the Clean Air Act regulations. So those were all in-state coal plants that fell under that law. Nevada sort of picked up on this and more recently has a reasonably similar kind of approach, which is a systematic approach to eliminating coal plants. This is NV Energy's coal plants, the retirement or elimination of 800 megawatts and then transition to other kinds of resources. One of the differences here, a notable difference, is that there are three coal plants in question that NV Energy has ownership or partial ownership of. Two of them are in Nevada, one of them is not. The two in Nevada are easier to shut down because they are within the jurisdiction of this statute. The one that is outside of the state is they are a minority owner, and so they don't talk about retiring that resource. They talk about eliminating it, which means just getting out from under that ownership, and there's really no guarantee that there will be any greenhouse gas emissions reductions from the resource out of state. So that really covers the issues that I wanted to touch on. I think that the lesson learned, or the summary, is that Oregon is doing quite a bit. We're doing a lot. There is no sort of overarching organizing principle the way a carbon price or a cap and trade might offer. But in terms of the number and breadth of policies, we actually have quite a bit. It is perhaps not as organized as California's is, for example, but we do have a full range of mechanisms.
Thank you. Senator Thompson?
I just had a quick question on that last slide. Nevada's reduction, it said they 300 MWs would be retired by December 31st, 2014. Did that actually happen?
I don't know. I can check on that.
Thanks.
Do you, by chance, know if Colorado's and Nevada's efforts were those legislative efforts at the ballot, unilateral action by agencies? What?
Chair Edwards, they were legislative. They were both legislative activities.
Okay.
Yes. Statutes.
Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Do you know how much revenue California generates for their cap and trade?
Senator Edwards, Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, no, I don't.
Great. Thank you.
Question.
Senator Dunbar.
Yeah. Thank you. So, I really appreciate the, you're breaking this down and showing what we've done. And some of those decisions, with respect to investments in coal. So, I mean, does the PUC, would you say in general, considers coal to be a risky investment? I mean, can you imagine a situation in which they would approve a plan that would include new coal-fired generators?
Chair Edwards, Senator Denbrough, given the first slide I showed, which is the EPA activity under the Clean Air Act, not only, I think, would a new coal plant be considered extraordinarily risky at this point, there is a significant amount of attention being paid by the Commission to the existing fleet. I'm sure Pacific Corp will come and testify in a moment, but a large percentage of their fleet, their coal fleet, has a number of different compliance obligations now being imposed upon it. And so when the Commission now looks at integrated resource planning, it's not just a brand new plant. The Commission is now looking at the investment it might take, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars of investment, to comply with the Clean Air Act. And so that's the comparison that we talked about, the net present value. Is it what's better for customers in terms of both cost and risk to make an investment and extend the life of a resource, or to consider an earlier shutdown? And some of it is going to depend – not some of it. A lot of it is going to depend on the size of the investment, the capital investment to be made, and it will also depend on the efficiency of any particular plant. Some coal plants are going to be more efficient than others, and so you run all that together, and then you try to run some net present value assessment and try to make those the best call you can make.
Could you speak a little bit more to, you said in the, was it the IRP process where you were considering different scenarios for prices on carbon? Go a little bit deeper there and explain exactly how you consider it, because I'm not sure that I understood how you use that information. Then once you figured that out, then that is considered, well, just explain it more.
Okay, Chair Edwards. So the IRP will have a number of different types of sets of portfolios consisting of different types of resources on existing and a going forward basis. We then run those portfolios against a number of different kinds of variables, and the carbon price is one of them. And this is looking forward and assuming perhaps Congress or the state adopts a carbon price at some point. That therefore, every megawatt hour that's coming out of a coal plant is going to have a carbon price associated with it, which makes it a little bit more expensive, ultimately for the ratepayer. And so you run those different portfolios. So, for example, just take extreme examples. One portfolio would have a new coal plant in it to serve increased load. Another portfolio would have energy efficiency and renewables. You then run those two different sets of portfolios against different carbon prices, and at certain point, the carbon price would become expensive enough for the output of those two portfolios that that one becomes a much better deal. The one that doesn't have any new carbon emissions becomes much less expensive than the one that does have carbon emissions. And so you don't actually know where that cutoff price is, which is why we asked the utility to run a number of different carbon scenarios, and then we sort of gauge, and it's more than two resource portfolios. It's several of them. It's many of them. And then you sort of can figure out how an impact, what the impact of a carbon price might have on a different set of portfolios.
Okay, that's helpful.
Did that help?
Yeah, it did.
So if you run these two scenarios and you can figure the carbon output from a coal plant and you run that price up enough so it's equal to or greater than a renewable resource, how does that impact the ratepayers?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, in that particular case, I suppose the cost of the ratepayer goes up, but what you are doing at the same time is reducing the risk of it going up even more. So the intent of the IRP has always been a least cost, least risk approach. And there is a sort of an idea of the efficiency frontier where you have an X and a Y axis. One X is increasing cost and the other is increasing risk, and you try to hit a sweet spot in the middle somewhere. So something that is very, very inexpensive may be very, very risky, and vice versa. And so the ultimate goal is to try to reduce the future risk as much as we can and yet keep rates as low as we can. So a lot of people think that IRP is simply a least cost tool, and it is a least cost, least risk tool, because ultimately if those risks do come to bear, that becomes a very, what seems cheap now may actually become very expensive down the road. And so we're trying to keep that least cost, least risk concept total.
Could you define risk as you're using it?
That's why I was going to ask the question. Oh,
we're giving
Chair Edwards. So there are.
Yeah, I'll give an example. We talk about rate risk, fluctuation risk,
CO2
risk of.
There are all kinds of risks. There are risks that load will not materialize, or, for example, no one could have really foreseen that in 2008 when load actually went down. So load might go up or down in a spiky kind of way. Another kind of risk would be volatility of fossil fuel prices, so natural gas prices. We will never be able to forecast really what the natural gas price is going to be. And right now we're in a very low period. It wasn't that long ago where natural gas prices were very high. CO2 prices is a different kind of risk in that it's sort of a legislative, it's sort of a policy risk. It's not a market risk. But you pull them all together, and there are a bunch of risks that we're trying to account for in the integrated resource plan, and it is to try to keep prices low, but it's also try to maintain the integrity of the system, not just on a short-term basis, but on a long-term basis as well.
Yeah. Okay, Senator Thompson.
And just a quick, so we talk about going from coal to natural gas, but we also talk about renewables. And then, so do somebody that are making those standards, do you look at what is out there, what is working? Because a lot of what I see in renewables is 10 or 15 years ago, we didn't have any windmill machines in Eastern Oregon, and now people out there are sick of looking at wind machines. They're everywhere you look, and they don't produce that much power. The solar energy is a great idea, but our technology isn't there yet. It was in the Oregonian a while back about the fiasco with the big solar plant that we put in. So do you look at what is out there and that it actually works and is feasible? Because a lot of these things sound good, and our technology is just not quite there yet to do it. But yet we've invested hundreds of millions of dollars in these things, and you watch solar plants go broke. And I believe in the future, at some point we'll get there. But sometimes we get ahead of technology, and then we waste a lot of money. So do you look at those kind of things, too, when you're making these portfolio decisions?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, so we don't imagine new technologies. Absolutely, we don't do that. We're looking at the commercial technologies at a commercialization stage. So wind is commercially viable, and so that is clearly in the mix, as is solar. But we don't try to extend those technologies and say we hope that technology will advance to a point in this IRP that it can begin to substitute for other resources. We try to be a little bit more pragmatic than that.
So, I'm sorry. Did you have a follow-up? No. Okay. So, following on that, I was talking with a developer of renewable energy that was talking about the particular stuff that they do, and they said, well, the renewable credit is great. It's like this much percentage of their revenue, but they said what really matters to them is the price. And so what I'm hearing from you is that in this planning process, you're considering price, you're considering risk. And so what other than goals or caps or something, you know, what drives the PUC to allow, you know, the extra 2 cents it takes or something like that that kind of opens up the market for those aspiring, you know, the next marginal amount of renewables, for instance.
Chair Edwards, so that's a good question with a very long answer. And so let me
let's keep it short.
No, I'll try to keep it short. So part of the value of the IRP is to recognize that so, for example, right now, wind may be struggling a little bit against natural gas because natural gas prices are very low. But none of us are foolish enough to think that we know exactly where the price of natural gas is always going to be. So that's actually one of the things in the IRP that they stress test is what happens if natural gas prices begin to get volatile or surge. And so at that stage, you can sort of view perhaps a temporarily more expensive resource now that may actually be a good deal for reducing risk over a longer period of time. Frankly, one of the things that we look at is what the legislature wants to do. There are a number of different goals, perhaps, with the development of wind. And as a hedge against volatile fossil fuel prices, because it doesn't carry any, it's a pretty good hedge.
Thank you. I'd like to get back into the cost, least cost versus risk. On a coal site, what's the risk on the coal site? Is it just the cost of the coal, or is it the CO2 emissions?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, the risks on the coal side, the commodity price is a risk. Probably, I think the risks that are driving the IRPs are the future carbon price, but also the compliance cost for mercury, haze, water, tailings of coal that are coming down. Those are, to be quite honest, remarkably expensive compliance obligations. That's why I wanted to show that first slide, is this isn't just 111D. 111D hasn't actually kicked in yet, and yet coal-heavy utilities are in a situation where there are a number of different compliance obligations coming. Some of them can be quite expensive, in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Oh, follow up?
Yeah.
And that's forced by the federal government, not the state governments?
Or Chair both? Edwards, Senator Olson, both. Primarily the federal government under the Clean Air Act.
Okay. Follow up?
Yeah.
Then on what's the risk on renewables, on wind energy? Because apparently there isn't any, except if the wind doesn't blow.
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, the capacity factors are all will be taken into account during that planning process. The risk would be the capital cost at the outset. So it would be to the extent that a renewable resource is significantly higher than the avoided cost of the market, that would be factored in. And ultimately, if it was too high, and in some scenarios with no CO2 price, for example, and a scenario with natural gas, then that portfolio just would get washed out.
But with the wind, isn't there a risk that there's no generation, so you have to factor in the risk of the backup generation in natural gas to augment it and to provide the base load?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, the integration of the variable energy resource, yes, that is all part of the cost of the renewable energy. If you have a heavy wind portfolio, for example, you're going to have to assume some cost for integration in that. That would be worked into the scenario.
One last follow-up.
Just one last. That's it. No, absolutely. I just want to point out the internet's a wonderful thing. The governor of California 2014-2015 budget appropriates $850 million from the auction, and that's not all of the money they got on cap and trade. Just for your information.
Thank you both for being here. Helpful, informative. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're going to close the informational hearing, or close the informational hearing on reducing carbon emissions through energy policy. And we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 477. And to get us started, Representative Reed is going to be arriving momentarily, and then I would also like to call up with Representative Reed, Rachel Shimshack and Bob Jenks. Okay. Why don't you guys start? Sounds like Representative Reed is voting at the moment in another committee, so he may be. He may be a few minutes, and he'll join you when he gets here.
We didn't coordinate who goes first, so it looks like I'm chosen. It's not a mix. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's Bob Jenks. I'm the executive director of the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. CUB is a nonprofit organization that is an advocate for residential ratepayers of utilities here in Oregon. One of the biggest risks that the customers I represent, residential ratepayers, face is coal. When I talk about the risk of coal, I'm talking about the financial risks associated with coal. That's what's going to come back to ratepayers. Coal has a target on its back. It's obviously a large source of carbon pollution, and it's a significant solution of air and water pollution. Increasingly, coal plants are required to do expensive upgrades for pollution control. The cost to Oregon utilities for these coal retrofits have already exceeded $2 billion, with another $1 billion coming between now and 2030. But after spending all this money on upgrading these coal plants, consumers are still at risk that future carbon regulation can shut down these plants and leave the customer and the utility fighting over hundreds of millions of dollars of stranded costs. This is a reason that about a decade ago, CUB opposed Pacific Coast proposals to invest in three new coal plants. Jason in a slide said they were two in the 2007 IRP. Those were the two that they were going to own. There was also a third one that they were trying to invest in. And we thought the idea of putting customer money into three new coal plants with what we knew about climate change and the risk that those coal plants would be subject to carbon regulation was not a good deal for customers. And we were successful in that. And then a few years later, we worked with Portland General Electric to find a way to phase out Boardman rather than invest $500 million in new plant upgrades and retrofits. And the bill that's in front of you really follows the same principle as that Boardman deal. Let's phase out the burning of coal on a timetable that makes it affordable and that avoids investing millions in environmental retrofits and protects customers from the future risk, financial risk associated with coal and carbon. And the bill, I'm going to walk through the bill as I view it, and I'm talking really about the amended bill. So this is really about the bill as amended, and it does several things. The first thing it does is it gives Oregon utilities 10 years to plan for phasing out coal use in Oregon, just like we gave PGE in 2010, we phased Boardman out in 2020. So we gave PGE 10 years. We're doing the same 10-year timetable here. And it creates an incentive to close the plants before 2030. The amendments in the bill say that if you got a commitment to close the plant before 2030, the clean energy standard that applies to the other plants doesn't apply to those ones that are closing. And that's important because if you close a coal plant, you reduce carbon emissions. And even if you replace it with natural gas, you're reducing carbon emissions. So the utilities have a lot more flexibility under this law if they're going to close a plant. It's also important for a multi-state utility like PacifiCorp, Oregon to impose a clean energy standard, a 90% clean energy standard on a coal plant that's closed that serves six states. The other five states deserve to have input in that replacement power. So the idea is that by giving them the flexibility for coal plants they close, it allows the replacement power to be based on the IRP with all the states providing, and creates a lot of flexibility for the utility in how they address those coal plants that are closing. Would you like me to pause and let?
No, go ahead. Finish your testimony, then we'll go to Representative Reed.
However, if a utility fails to develop a plan to close a coal plant by 2030, then starting in 2025, it can no longer use that coal plant to serve customers in Oregon. And instead, it has to that's the power that would then have to be replaced with the 90% cleaner than coal. But even for those plants that have to be replaced by 90% cleaner than coal, the utility would have 7 to 12 years that it could phase in that clean energy component by using market purchases as an alternative under the bill. So you can use market purchases, you can contract for up to 5 years, and you can do that for up to 7 years. So 7 plus 5 gives you 12 years that you can use market purchases to phase in the development of the clean energy standard. So there's a lot of flexibility in there. And then there's one other component of flexibility in the amended version of the bill. We don't know what market conditions are going to be. I don't know what hydro conditions are going to be in 2025. We could be in a significant drought, which raises market prices. So there's a release valve where the commission can look at those market conditions and say, where the market is right now isn't a good place to use market purchases to phase in the standard. So we're going to phase in this bill over the next 5 years, which will allow us to get to different market conditions. So that's really what the bill did. And I said initially that this bill is really about protecting customers from the financial risk of coal. PacifiCorp is about two-thirds coal. If there is a price on carbon, it's PacifiCorp's customers that are going to get hammered. Jason talked a lot about utility planning, and I live a lot of my life in that utility planning IRP process. And in that planning process, we have to assume there's going to be carbon costs in the future. It would be irresponsible to sort of build an asset that produces carbon and assume zero carbon regulation over the next 20 years, because there's likely to be some carbon regulation happening at some time. We don't know exactly when, we don't know what, there's different ways it could happen, but you got to figure in the future carbon regulation is coming. In their last IRP, the last IRP that was acknowledged by the commission, PacifiCorp's base case, so they looked at a number of different carbon scenarios, but their base case that they used assumed that carbon regulation would be the equivalent cost of about $16 a ton beginning in 2020 and escalating from there. Now, it's important to recognize that $16 per ton carbon cost through regulation is about a 20% rate increase for customers of PacifiCorp, and it's an even greater rate increase for their industrial customers, about a 25% increase. So carbon regulation is a real financial risk to the customers of the utility. And really, when you look at what the bill does, the bill is going to add some costs. By requiring the clean energy standard for the bills for the coal plants that they don't actually close. But the cost of that clean energy plant, we spent a lot of time looking at the cost of this and sitting down and modeling this using numbers primarily from the IRP. But when we do that, what we find is the costs that we're avoiding through the potential regulation of carbon and the clean. Jason listed the various clean air obligations that the companies have on regional haze and other stuff, the $1 billion of clean air investment that we expect between now and 2030. By avoiding those things, we're offsetting the new costs associated with the clean energy standard. So the modeling we've done suggests that the cost of this bill is essentially a wash. We're adding some new costs, but by reducing carbon, we're eliminating some other costs, and by reducing coal, we're eliminating some other costs. And they're about equal in the work that we've done. And that's important. And again, the carbon costs that we're using in there are from Pacifico in their last IRP. They aren't something we went out. In our analysis, we weren't trying to do a best case scenario. We were trying to do a realistic case scenario. So that's really what in my mind the bill does, is it says we're going to reduce our risk of carbon costs and carbon regulation and the costs that's going to put on customers, and we're going to invest that money in clean energy and reducing the carbon of our system. And then I want to just sort of close with one comment. It's one criticism I've heard about this bill is that we should be focusing on carbon, not coal, and that the solution to climate change is really ultimately a price on carbon. But understand that a price on carbon will hammer customers. Jason mentioned British Columbia. British Columbia is a hydro system. A price on carbon from the electric system in British Columbia doesn't hurt consumers very much. A price on carbon into PacifiCorp customers at 67% coal is really going to hammer them. And I'm an economist. I will tell you, price signals work. If you put a price on carbon for PacifiCorp customers, they'll cut back. I'll dial back my thermometer. Industries may close, cut a shift, and cut production because of that 25% increase. You can force reductions in carbon emissions by raising the price of electricity. But that's a really pretty punitive way to do it, and it hurts customers, and it really hurts low-income customers. And why I agree, I'm somebody who would tell you that I think a price on carbon is likely to be part of how we deal with carbon regulation going forward. But to protect customers from that, the best thing we can do if we believe a price on carbon is the right solution in the long term is start to work today to reduce the amount of carbon in our electric sector. Because it's only by reducing the amount of carbon, and the only way to really do that is to reduce the amount of coal in our electric system. It's doing that is what's going to make, later on when carbon regulation comes, is it's going to make that affordable and make that not hammer and hurt consumers of Oregon. So from my viewpoint, that's really the trade-off of this bill. We're trying to protect customers from future carbon regulation by making the system cleaner today. And so when carbon regulation gets here, customers aren't going to have a huge, they're not going to be whammied, they're not going to have huge price increases. We're going to be able to manage that situation pretty well. So that's really what I want to say, and I'm happy to answer any questions people have.
Thank you. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed. I apologize for my late arrival. As you know, there are other committees going on, and I was stuck close to where there might be a vote in another committee, so my apologies.
Oh, was that a vote? I thought it was a boat. He was on a boat.
Not a boat yet.
Heading down.
Mr. Chair, Senator Przanski, thank you for that. I want to talk about the choice that we have in Oregon. On one hand, we could invest in aging coal plants, despite our well-founded and well-grounded knowledge that of all the downsides of that, the contributions to climate change and the negative impacts on the environment. But on the other hand, we have a chance to invest in a renewable energy future where we open up the opportunity for new industries and where we can establish and reinforce our strong renewable energy industry and the infrastructure and the knowledge that needs to that we need to support them. Imagine we all remember what Yogi Berra said about what to do when you come to a fork in the road. You should take it. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to go down one of these paths. We're going to make one of these choices. Even if we don't do anything, that is a choice. And if we choose the former, aging coal plants are going to need investments and upgrades down that path. But if we support this bill or something like it, we can choose a new future for ourselves, for our kids, and for generations of Oregonians to come. I think we have a chance to support an innovative industry, create jobs in our backyard, and ensure that we're continuing to work hard for the values that we share as Oregonians. I've been here in this building a little while, and I know that moving away from coal is a long conversation. We clearly need to be smart and thoughtful about that transition and ensure it's done with as little impact as possible. And I think that's what what this bill seeks to do. It keeps us moving in the right direction. It, I think, acknowledges the complex factors that others have already talked about, but I think it is time for us to take action. I suspect that you'll hear opponents of this approach talk about coal as if it's free, and it is clearly the path of least resistance. But as you've heard today, and even as has been reported recently in the New York Times and other places, it's not free. Those opponents might say that we shouldn't make any transition and we should just do nothing if we want to keep our costs down. But I think they're presenting a false choice because, as I said, and others say, coal isn't free. I want us to choose to invest in those cleaner energy resources to protect our environment, create good-paying jobs in construction, engineering, manufacturing, technology. And I think the Dash 1 amendments have already been talked about. I think they're priced to move. They represent a deliberate transition with plenty of time, with opportunity for utility customers and utility companies to transition in the way that makes most sense for them. And I think they make a lot of sense. We have a lot of things before us in the legislature. Some of them are very short-term, how we're going to boost the K-12 budget, all the social services that are needed. But we also sometimes have the opportunity to deal with really long-term problems and really visionary kinds of solutions that highlight the future we want and are consistent with our values. And I think this is one of those times. Like you, I suspect, I have heard from my constituents, from business owners, from friends, from colleagues, all people who care about setting up a path for Oregon to move away from coal because the impact it's going to have on our future, our economic future, our environmental future, the future that we're going to share together. I think this bill really affirms that we are our best in Oregon when we're working together to find innovative ways, creative ways to do that, and I think that's who we are. So let's get started. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. You're welcome to stay if you want to, but I know you're in the middle of the committee, so you're welcome to leave now.
I am very tempted. I think this is going to be a very good conversation, Mr. Chair, but I do think I better get back from my other obligations. So thank you.
Sounds good. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
Do you want questions for Bob, or do you want me to?
No, both of you, and then we'll do questions.
Great. So. Thank you, Senator Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Shimshack. I'm the executive director of Renewable Northwest. We are a regional nonprofit organization, and our goal is to promote the expansion of environmentally responsible new renewable resources in the Northwest. Our members are an interesting combination of consumer, environmental, academic institutions, and also businesses actively working to implement, to develop, and to manufacture renewable energy resources. We are unified by a vision of making a clean, affordable, renewable energy future a reality that supports our economy, our climate, and our quality of life. And together with our members and our allies in all of the states of the Northwest, we've seen 8,000 megawatts of new renewable energy be developed. That's enough to avoid 15 million metric tons of carbon emissions. But I'm here today to voice our support for Senate Bill 477, the Dash 1 amendments, and say that we believe that this is a reasonable and practical policy that signals Oregon's path and acts in Oregonians' interest in reducing coal and its risks and increasing the amount of clean energy in our supply. The bill provides a very long lead time for utilities and regulators and other parties to plan for this transition in a least cost and least risk way. Bob alluded to the many elements of flexibility that are included in the Dash 1 amendments, so I won't belabor that point. I would just say one item that he didn't mention was as coal is eliminated from our supply or our allocation in Oregon, utilities can determine what their actual needs are and replace those as opposed to a one-for-one replacement of the coal that was eliminated. This particular approach designed in this bill takes a little bit of a different strategy than other policies that we have entertained in Oregon. And by saying that the replacement power has to be 90% cleaner than the coal that it's replacing, that calls on the utilities and all of the stakeholders to figure out the combination of resources that can best meet our needs, meet the environmental criteria, and keep reliable energy serving customers. It also, importantly, and this is my thing, you just got to understand this from my perspective, it signals the market that Oregon wants to continue to build on its clean energy path. Without policies like this, businesses who have been active in our state and in our region may take their limited capital and deploy it in other places that look like they have more opportunity. This proposal is complementary, we believe, to the federal regulations that Jason and his colleague described before, the 111D EPA regulations. We now know that regulating carbon is not just a possibility, but a reality. And whatever the final rule says when it comes out in July or thereabouts, Oregon will be in a better place if we continue to transition away from coal and toward clean energy. And we should get started now. I know that utilities think about these things over a very long period of time, and I think people don't want to wait. We see what the future will bring. We want to act now to reduce risks for customers and reduce costs. It's also consistent with the state's greenhouse gas goals that were adopted several years ago, and it puts us on a good trajectory for additional carbon policy. So when additional carbon policy is in place, we will have taken steps to reduce the impact on the citizens of Oregon. Many states, including ours, I mean, Jason went through the list of policies that Oregon has adopted already. We have many of them. There is usually no one policy that's going to do everything. Policies work together and strategically put us in a better place. We have a lot of renewable energy potential in the state and in the region, and renewables are ready. We know that because both PGE and PacifiCorp and other utilities around the region have acquired and deployed these resources, figured out how to put them in their supplies, and reliably serve their customers with them. The diversity benefits, the environmental benefits, the stabilization of rates over the long term because of their lack of fuel costs are adding benefits for the state every day. We have a whole bunch of wind projects, as was mentioned before, 38 in the state, 3 geothermal projects, and thousands of solar customers along the way. We have solar manufacturing facilities like Solar World and Solaix in Multnomah and Washington counties, along with the North American headquarters of Vestas, Iberdrola, employing over 1,000 people together. The wind and solar projects are really often deployed on the east side of the state, and that has helped Sherman and Gillum and Morrow and Umatilla and Union County receive tax benefits totaling over $110 million so far. That's helped them invest in public safety, school programs, road repairs, other vital services for counties. We're in a really different scene than we were even 5 years ago. 5 years ago, we have much more efficient wind turbines. We have much more efficient solar panels. We have new technologies and new market capability to be able to balance these resources. The prices, because of our policies in Oregon and other policies around the states and at the federal government, have come down unbelievably in the last 5 years, 50% for wind and even more than that for solar. I happened to see this on my desk today. This is the Wind Integration Action Plan that the Northwest Power Planning and Conservation Council did in 2007 because the region was very worried about being able to integrate 6,000 megawatts of wind by 2020. And a lot of good work was done. A lot of utilities and other stakeholders participated in that. I'm happy to say that we have over 8,000 megawatts of wind today, and we're still 5 years from 2020. It's being integrated into our system, and we're benefiting from it. So we have good policies, but we want something that sends the message that Oregon is interested in transitioning off of coal power and investing in additional clean energy resources, that we want our utilities to figure out how to combine those resources together to supply reliable power to their customers. And that's our goal. Thank you very much.
Thank you both for being here. Questions of this panel? Senator Przonski.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if this is a question for the panel or for yourself. I had a constituent who emailed me knowing that the hearing was happening regarding the Dash 1s, and there's a shift as to the philosophy, I guess, from their perspective of phase out for coal plants, where it's, they were under the belief it was a 2025 deadline. Now it says that they can count those facilities, I'm assuming Boardman, to be phased out by 2030. They're in that five-year period, and I'm wondering if this is just part of a need to move the bill, or if this was some type of reasoning as to giving that extra 5 years, at least from the constituents' perspective.
Mr. Chair, Senator Przonski, what they're referring to, I think, is the flexibility where we've said if the utility is going to close a coal plant by 2030, we'll allow. So Pacifico's got some plants that are facing major environmental upgrades in 2027. And so what we want to do is, rather than saying they got to stop selling that coal to Oregon, we expect that by 2025 they're going to be planning to close those plants in 2027 and discontinue them. And all the states that serve Pacifico will be sitting around a table trying to figure out what do we do about those plants when they close down in 2027. So we took the position that it doesn't make sense to force those plants to stop serving Oregon, take us out of the discussion in the IRP of how to replace them. And so those coal plants, but it's only a handful of coal plants that I think are likely to be in that path, where between 2025 and 2030 that they would be candidates for closure. But if a plant is going to commit to closing between 25 and 2030, you're right, it can live in Oregon rates a little bit past 2025. This doesn't extend Boardman past 2020.
That's right.
Okay.
Boardman will close in 2020. That's part of its operating license. It would be in real trouble with EPA if it kept going. It would be in violation of its pollution permit, and PGE wouldn't be in that position. This legislature does not have the power to extend the life of Boardman.
I appreciate that.
And that's not what this bill is intending to do.
All right, so it's for these, if I can follow up, on these secondary plants that we're receiving some type of energy from at this point. And what if, for some reason, they are not closed within that five-year period?
But the bill requires a binding agreement to close them in there, so it's similar to Boardman. Boardman, what the EPA, in order to allow Boardman to phase out in 2020, required a binding commitment.
Okay.
And we sat around a table and figured out that putting that into the pollution permit itself is a binding agreement, because if it's operating in 2021, it's in violation of its pollution permit. So it would be a similar type of arrangement.
All right. Thanks for the clarification. Yeah. Constituent will sleep well tonight.
Mr. Chair, Senator Przonski, if I could just embellish for a second. So this doesn't have an impact on Boardman, because Boardman is going to close in 2020. We tried to put an incentive in the bill to interest utilities in making a commitment by 2025 to close a facility. And if they did that, then the clean energy standard would not apply to that facility. We know that we can't close facilities that are in other states, but we can allow for some incentives to try to get them there. And by Oregon stepping forward and with the values that we have, indicating that we want to transition off of coal by 2025, that shifts the risk to the other states that do own those plants, and then they have to make the judgment about whether or not they want to continue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
To start with, I want you to clarify what our renewable bases or our renewable products are. What do we have? Wind, solar, what else?
Well, there are a lot of Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, sorry. I'm going to get this one of these days. We have plenty of different renewable resources that serve customers today. Senator Thompson mentioned the hydro system, which, of course, that's our renewable edge, right? We're trying to build on that and diversify that into the future.
But that doesn't count.
It's in our energy supply, and it is keeping us from having to have resources that have greater emissions. So that's how it helps us so far. So in this sense, it does, it is having an impact.
Save for the fact many Oregon customers can't take advantage of the BPA power system, Pacific Corp, PGE, et cetera. So they're precluded from that. So it really doesn't count for them.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, it is true that the public utilities certainly get first dibs on Bonneville's vast hydro system, but the investor-owned utility customers, and Bob can speak to this better than I can, also get a value from that energy system because of the residential exchange, which is a archaic thing, but it is a way for investor-owned utility customers to benefit from the benefits of the hydro
system. Okay, let's go back to our renewables. What are they?
Wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, hydro, wave, tidal, okay. Offshore.
Follow up. How many are now actually commercially viable and are actually generating into our system? We know wind. We know solar.
Wind, solar,
we
geothermal.
We have biomass. Geothermal plants?
Yes, we have three geothermal plants, okay. One in eastern Oregon, two in southern Oregon.
Fine, thank you. Now, you mentioned several times, follow up, please. Thank you. You mentioned several times, and you use this this term often, reliable energy. Is wind and solar a reliable baseload energy source?
Wind and solar are energy resources, and in order to produce a reliable resource portfolio, you need energy, you need capacity, and you need flexibility. And the utilities are experts at figuring out how to put those things together to deliver reliable power to their customers.
But follow up, thank you. Is it a reliable baseload source other than biomass?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I wouldn't say that wind and solar are baseload resources, but I would say that they contribute both to energy and to capacity for the system. And the system, the responsibility of the portfolio is to meet the energy needs of the customers, and it takes a portfolio to be able to do that. On the issue of reliability, I would say that we have a lot of very large single resources that serve us as customers, and when one of the in the system, you have to plan for one of those to go out, so you have to buy additional resources just in case one of those large facilities goes out. The Colstrip plant, for instance, during our very hot summer last year, was not available. It went down with a technical problem. So there are other resources in the supply that can be deployed to meet people's energy needs. The beauty of having more renewable resources and cleaner energy and also using demand response and energy efficiency and other resources is that each resource is smaller, more distributed, and if any one resource doesn't function, it doesn't take as much to replace them. So
Follow up, and then we need to move on.
Okay, that's fine.
Because we've got an opposition panel coming up.
I know. If Pacific Corp was to pull out their 1,300 megawatts that they put into our state, how many turbines would it take or solar panels would it take to replace that energy?
Can you do the math?
I can't do the math on that off the top of my head, though we have done spreadsheets where we've looked at that and trying to look at the cost and I believe it's affordable and doable. But I also think the first thing is to recognize that some of the plants are going to be closed and some of the Pacifico plants are already scheduled to close, and those ones they could replace under the Dash 1 amendments with entirely gas. Even with the 90% clean energy standard, it allows for 10% gas. PGE just put in the Port Westwood 2 plant, which is a flexible gas plant. That means it can ramp up quickly. So as it can balance the increases and decreases in wind. It's right next to a storage facility at Mist. So it has gas there on call, so it doesn't have to keep pipeline capacity all the time in order to do it. It's got a gas supply that's flexible. It's a flexible gas gas plant, and the future is going to be more of that kind of flexible gas plant and more renewables on the system, and that's how we're going to sort of balance the system in the future. And this bill allows for gas, but gas's role is increasingly going to be what PGE's already done. And PGE, I suspect, is on the later utility panel. You can ask them about Port Westward 2 and the ability of gas to provide that integration and that kind of function going forward.
Are there any considerations for nuclear?
Senator, we need to move on.
That's fine.
I told you ahead of time. Thank you both for being here. I'm sorry. We could go for 3 hours on this, and we just need to move on. So thank you both for being here.
Happy to talk
please
later.
Follow up with the yes. Senator. I get answers to all of his questions. I appreciate it. We have an opposition panel up next, Scott Bolton and Varner Seaman. And then they will be allotted a lot of time as well. And then that is going to basically leave everybody else that's here to testify on it with just about no time. So I may even just call for raising hands if you're here to support, raising hands if you're here to oppose, or we will go very quickly, like in 30-second or 1 minute increments. But there's a lot of technical details that we need to get through, and the previous panel and this panel have more technical knowledge than other folks, in my judgment. So please.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, here representing Portland General Electric. Thank you very much for the time to consider this bill today and give us the opportunity to testify. PGE is testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 477 today, and there are three things that I'm going to talk about. The first is we're doing a lot already to reduce carbon emissions. I want to spend a moment talking about what's happening in the status quo from our perspective. I want to talk a little bit about second point, which is this is fairly complicated work and some of the considerations that have to go into resource planning and looking at the replacement of resources and some concerns with the timing of this measure. And then third, building on what the folks from DEQ and the PUC talked about earlier, talking about the timing of this proposal and some concerns about taking up this piece of legislation during the 2015 session. So first, as folks have talked about with the Boardman planned cessation of coal burning at the end of 2020, it's always a little funny to be in one of these hearings talking about Boardman because that's going to be my big thing to talk about, and folks kind of take away some of the thunder, but we'll talk about it a little bit more anyway. What's worth noting with Boardman is it's the first national example of a utility voluntarily stopping coal combustion at a coal facility nationally. We think that we provide some national leadership in terms of making that decision and working with stakeholders and coming up with, as folks noted, a binding agreement to stop using coal at Boardman by 2020. It's also one of it's notable in that it's a younger and more efficient coal plant than some of the older coal plants that come offline. I think that that's worth some recognition. I'm being a little bit precise in language, we talk about cessation of coal activities at Boardman 2020. We are studying the potential to use biomass at the Boardman facility, and we're doing a test burn later this spring to see if we can use some of the biomass from the state to replace some of that coal power, and we're going to see if we can have some success there. So that's a big part of the story for Portland General Electric. It's a big part of the story potentially for 111D compliance for the state of Oregon is shifting away from coal at the Boardman facility, which is Oregon's only coal-fired plant. Further on in carbon reduction for PGE, we have a commitment to reducing carbon emissions, and our customers have a commitment to reducing carbon emissions. PGE's customers are number one in the participation in voluntary renewable energy programs nationally. We understand that this is a direction our customers want to go, and we support moving away from fossil generation and supporting renewables to the extent that we can plan for that and have those integrated into our system in a way that makes sense. To that end, Portland General Electric supported the original passage of the Renewable Portfolio Standard and has been an active voice in defending the Renewable Portfolio Standard in various legislative attempts to weaken the standard over the last few years. We also have gone on record in various filings with the Public Utilities Commission and in front of this body talking about our intent to physically comply with the Renewable Portfolio Standard by meeting a 25% of our power coming from renewable energy by 2025. As well, PGE is a strong supporter of energy efficiency and achieving all cost-effective energy efficiency, and it's something that we think is priority, again, for our customers, and we've seen some pretty significant emissions reductions based on that. When we do build new fossil generation, which was talked about with Port Westward 2 a moment ago, and we have under construction the Cardi Generating Station in northeastern Oregon, which is also a gas plant, when we make those investments in fossil generation, we also invest in offsets through the Climate Trust, as is required in statute under Oregon law. In total, when we look at these actions and others for Portland General Electric, by 2030, we expect to see a 17% reduction in the carbon emissions for Portland General Electric over the baseline year of 2005. So from 2005 to 2030, about a 17% reduction in emissions on our system. And that's occurring while we have overall load growth that's occurring in our system. And I think one of the bright spots in the economy in the state of Oregon is Washington County and the Portland metro area, where we do have pretty significant growth taking place. Even with that growth, we will be cutting the total amount of carbon emissions from our system. We understand the concern that our customers and that our state has, that many of the folks in the state, many of our customers have, about climate and about carbon emissions, and so we are taking action to reduce our emissions and to reduce the carbon footprint. There was some discussion earlier about defense of coal and about some concern about new investments and new build of coal. Representative Reed talked a fair amount, kind of created a straw man argument about folks saying coal is cheap, coal's free. We're supporting that. I don't think that that is the argument that I'm making today. No resource is free. Any energy that we develop is going to have impacts. Any human activity where we disturb the environment, if we build a wind farm, if we build a solar facility, if we build a gas plant, if we build a coal facility, if we build a dam, those impacts, those facilities, each and every one of them is going to have impacts on the environment. I also want to be very clear, when Jason was talking about the emissions performance standard earlier, it's not one of the things that's really a marquee piece of legislation in the state of Oregon, but it effectively means that we will not, as utilities in the state of Oregon, be building new coal plants. That's off the table. It's not something that's going to be taking place. There is not a discussion that's taking place for the construction of new coal plants. And I don't want anybody to walk away from this hearing today thinking that there are plans out there for new coal facilities to be constructed. That's just simply not the case. So that was the first part. We're doing a lot already. Two, energy issues are complicated. When we build a new plant, there's a lot that goes into it. We have to look at whether there's available transmission. We have to look at the siting of that plant. We have to look at whether or not we can get a permit for that facility. We have to look at how those facilities integrate with the rest of our system. We have to look at what the costs are going to be for consumers, what the fuel costs are going to be, what the forward price of fuel costs are going to be. When we look at this piece of legislation, the variability and the complexity of any individual resource decision that we would make is magnified when we start to look at swapping out a full third of the resource mix in the Oregon's electrical system in a fairly short period of time. That degree of complexity, we think, is hard to fully understand. When we do modeling runs for our integrated resource plan, those are complicated. They take a significant amount of time. As we're having conversations with this legislation, what we've done in the past in the state of Oregon is we've gotten lots of parties together, the regulators, customers of the utilities themselves, different state agencies that are involved in the permitting and the planning of facilities, and we've had in-depth discussions about how we move forward. We have not had that conversation on this bill, and I think one of the things that we're concerned about is what are both the intended and potential unintended consequences of this piece of legislation, and have we had time to fully vet it? The Dash 1 amendments we just received yesterday, and you know, this is a bill that's been out since December. We received the original copy of the bill, just receiving the Dash 1 amendments yesterday for a fairly significant and complex piece of legislation. I would assert that that's not a sufficient amount of time to look at passing this bill in the 2015 session, which is to the final point around timing of this bill. With the 111D rules coming up this summer, with final rules in place, we don't know exactly what those rules are going to look like. There is some question in terms of how Boardman is going to be treated. There are questions in terms of how much energy efficiency we're going to be credited based on, frankly, nationally leading work that we've been doing. And in my conversations with PUC and then some of these presentations over the last few months, there's a concern that we're only going to be getting, as Jason Eisdorfer said earlier, cents on the dollar. 111D and the final plan for 111D may require fairly significant investments both between utility customers and the state of Oregon. I think that there's a question about where those investments need to occur, and if we've got effectively a bucket of money from ratepayers and a bucket of money from taxpayers, I would caution us against making the decisions about how we spend those resources prior to knowing what the final plan is going to be under 111D, and making those decisions without having the benefit of understanding what direction are we going to be encouraged to invest beyond what we've determined is cost-effective in Oregon for energy efficiency. Are we going to need to do more investments in renewable energy? Are we going to have to do some other type of activity that we can't anticipate right now until that plan is final? Additionally, we may need to look at pretty close coordination with other states, in particular the state of Montana. In the last couple weeks, representatives of the governor's office, DEQ, and the Public Utilities Commission took a trip to Montana to talk about coordination with the state of Montana. Yesterday, there was a hearing in Montana on a bill that was pushing back on some efforts in Washington state to force the closure of those plants in that state. And what we understand from folks in the state of Montana is that some of the efforts right now that are being conducted in the Washington legislature, not terribly dissimilar from this legislation, are causing problems with the relationship between the states and could potentially have some pretty significant blowback in our ability to have multi-state interaction in terms of 111D implementation. I think that the interests of the state of Montana, while that's not the primary consideration for this body, I think as we look at how we comply with the federal rule, I think it's important for us to take into consideration. Finally, we do acknowledge that the Dash 1 amendments seem to be some fairly significant changes to this bill, but we haven't fully had time to analyze and vet those. Again, the process of our resource planning is pretty time-consuming. There are a lot of folks that have to look at things, first lawyers to interpret what the language says, and then second, resource planners to look through and figure out how we would actually implement the rules as proposed. And I would just posit for this legislative session, these are too big a changes coming too quickly for us to seriously understand what the full implications of it would be. So just in summary, we're doing a lot already. We're concerned about the complexity of this legislation and its relationship to the existing system, and we don't think the timing is right during this this legislative session to pass this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Corp. Thank you for the opportunity to share some views on Senate Bill 477 and in particular the Dash 1s. As you may know, Pacific Corp is a regional investor-owned utility. We serve six western states. We're an Oregon-incorporated business with a headquarters in Portland. And we serve about 560,000 customers across Oregon as Pacific Power, our retail unit, and have customers or assets in about 31 of Oregon's 36 counties, and we're, for practical purposes, the state's largest rural electricity provider. For the purposes of today, it's important to understand that we operate our business on an integrated system basis. And what that means is that, and I handed out a map of all the generation plants that we have in our portfolio, what it means is that we put all of our costs of generation resources and transmission lines that move electricity around the region into a bucket and basically apportion costs based on the load of each state. So as we look at policies in Oregon, such as Senate Bill 477, it's good to understand that Oregon comprises about 25% of the cost of everything that you see there on the map. So whether it's a wind farm in Oregon, like the Leaning Juniper project, which is located here, 25% of the costs of and benefits of that resource are allocated to Oregon, as is the Jim Bridger coal plant in Wyoming, 25%. And the remaining five states in our system are allocated the remaining 75%. And this is the most efficient way that we found to deploy capital and operate our system so that we're not overbuilding or, frankly, underbuilding to meet customers' needs. We welcome the conversation that Senate Bill 477 brings, but we do believe it needs to be part of a bigger conversation, one that, frankly, builds on the presentation earlier around the Federal Environmental Protection Agency Clean Power Plan. We should be talking about how we meet new federal regulations. We should talk about how to actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And we should talk about what that means as far as the types of investments and timing of investments that we need to make in the grid in order to make that plan work. And we need to do so with an eye on affordability for customers. To be clear, we have a number of concerns about the cost and feasibility of Senate Bill 477. And as Varner said, and we agree, this legislation is just simply not ready for prime time. There's a lot of questions and concerns about the ideas contained within the legislation. But the questions raised, and it's interesting, the question raised about what the state can do to help covered entities, utility systems, meet the new 111D requirements is a good one. It's one that will obviously be better informed once we have a final 111D rule. But I do want to take a moment and kind of posit where this really goes, because I think some of the idea behind this legislation is fear. It's the fear of what there may be as far as future carbon regulation. And from our perspective, carbon regulation, power plant regulation for carbon dioxide emissions is here. That's what the Clean Power Plan addresses. That's what the 111D rule is. Certainly states may someday, for whatever reasons, opt to carbon tax themselves. But the way that we look at 111D is that when you measure optimizing your system and reducing emissions to meet a cap or a target in each state, or preferably across a region, that cost of meeting that regulation versus what you would otherwise do on a purely economic basis, a business as usual basis, is your carbon price. That is your cost of compliance. We do have carbon costs coming. We're starting to be able to measure those as we see the 111D rule come into relief. And frankly, that's how we intend to meet our carbon reduction obligations. We're confident that while challenging, and as Varner just said, we do not know all the answers yet to what the final rule that the EPA will provide. We do believe it's workable. We do believe it's achievable. And we have been taking measures over the last decade to prepare for this. Mr. Jenks, in his testimony, talked about the carbon pricing that we put into our resource planning, basically a thumb on the scale, anticipating that there will someday be carbon regulation. Up until our 2013 resource plan, we did that. We ran a number of different carbon price signals within our resource planning that was a proxy for what future carbon regulation would look like. Where we are with our 2015 plan, the one that we're working on now and we'll be bringing to regulators soon for acknowledgement, does not have that carbon price signal in it. And it doesn't because of what I just said, because now we have an actual uniform federal policy that will be governing emissions emanated from all fossil fuel fired generation plants. So now we actually have some real world regulation and some real world options as to what are the least cost solutions to be able to keep the lights on and yet keep affordability in the forefront for our customers. We have been doing the exercise of putting a carbon price signal in our resource planning since for over 10 years now. And frankly, we've seen that tool as well as the other suite of clean air regulations, lowering the company's emissions over the last 10 years. So by 2025, we expect to get less, you know, as you've heard before, we're over 60% coal reliant now. We'll be under 50% by 2025. By 2030, we'll be below 40%, and we'll continue a downward trajectory as the coal plants, and if you look on the back of the map there or the handout, as you start seeing those aging plants simply run to the end of their lifespan. We've also been ramping up our renewables. We've gone from only 42 megawatts of wind generation in 2004, and in 10 years have reached about 2,000 megawatts. That's enormous and frankly makes us the largest wind-owning utility in the western U.S., and we're second nationally only to our sister company in Iowa. Our most recent plan, resource plan that we're looking at for 2015, identifies 800 megawatts of new power purchase agreements that are queued up to enter our system for new wind and solar. That's a massive amount and will go a long way, not just to helping us meet 111D requirements, but also to defer additional power plant investment that we would need to do. And of course, all of that doesn't reflect that we continue to invest in and operate our hydro fleet and that we're the largest biomass purchaser in the state of Oregon. In addition, we're one of the first utilities to aggressively start seeking energy efficiency opportunities with our customers. Going all the way back to the 1960s, we were running customer-oriented programs. And today we work closely with the Energy Trust of Oregon to identify all cost-effective energy efficiency we could possibly achieve and also put that into our planning to make sure that we aren't building more power plants than we possibly need. In our current plan, we're currently looking at meeting projected load growth by 86% energy efficiency. So that's using existing assets, even as we have other plants going away within that plan, including a coal plant in Utah that will be closing at the end of April of this year. 86% of our energy needs over the next decade will be met with energy efficiency. We know we're moving towards a lower carbon future. We've been doing the right things, and as carbon, federal carbon regulation comes into sharper focus, we'll continue to do more in order to meet and comply with that, those standards. But we have to maintain cost competitiveness. We have to stay affordable, particularly for the rural communities of Oregon that have been left behind in the economic recovery. Simply put, if you look at our map and the parts of the state that we serve, many of those communities continue to struggle and really can't afford anything that is more than sharp public policy that really balances interests. And that's really one of the messages that we want to leave here today, is that we know that this is a conversation that has to be inclusive, and it has to, frankly, be inclusive of the communities that will ultimately bear the burden and pay the bills for whatever the state of Oregon decides. Senate Bill 477 does not reduce greenhouse gases, and it doesn't adequately contain costs, but we need to continue to work towards what that might look like. And one of the concerns I have with the Dash Ones is that it uniquely focuses costs on Oregonians in a way that's more painful than necessary, that there probably are better ways to get at achieving lower carbon emissions associated with Oregon without the restrictions or the types of tools being eliminated from the toolbox. The grid is regional by nature, and Oregon is not going to be able to close coal plants in other states, just like other states aren't going to be able to remove dams in Oregon. And so, to Varner's earlier point, regional cooperation and having relationships between states is probably going to be one of the most effective ways for individual states to get the most benefit out of what they do and their history of public policy measures in order to meet the new federal rules in the most economically feasible way. And so we want to make sure that that Oregon leaders have some perspective about what policy decisions here in Salem may mean in other state capitals around the West. So we recognize the desire to create a forum to talk about lowering Oregon's emissions. We welcome that. We want to continue that. We think that the timing is right as the federal rules are issued this summer. And we look forward to working with folks. But passing this bill at this time and ahead of knowing where those rules are going to land is just simply premature. So thank you. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. You rattled off some numbers about where you are currently and where you're going, and I can't type fast enough. So
sure.
Can you say those again?
So our most current resource plan, in which we update every 2 years, has us getting less than 50% of our energy generation from coal by 2025, and that's going to be reflective of the closure of the Carbon plant in aptly named Carbon County, Utah, this year in April 2015.
Seriously?
Seriously?
That's the name of it.
Okay.
With also a retirement of the use of coal at the Naughton plant in Wyoming and switching to natural gas for Unit 3 there, and for the either the closure or the fuel switch of the Cholla 4 plant in Arizona.
And when are those happening, Scott?
2015, 2017 or 18 with Naughton, and 2025 with Cholla. And all of these are before we've had full application of the 111D rule. So the way that we look at this is fairly simple. It's a slide rule exercise. There's a finite lifespan for these resources, just as there's a finite lifespan for any machine. The more you compress that time span, the more cost that there is to deal with, whether it's the remaining investment in the plant or the timing of what you're going to replace that plant with. And so given enough time, given the space to make smart investments, you know, we know that we're going to get to a lower carbon portfolio. We know that we're going to move through these plants and we're going to replace them with other resources. It's just whether that slide rule, you know, it's what's the sweet spot. It's how much do you want to pay and how fast do you want to have it done. And as Oregon being only a quarter of the ownership or the responsibility, if you will, of the resources, it's necessarily a regional conversation that includes and impacts millions of people in other places, and that needs to be taken into consideration.
Mr. Chair, sorry, but I have my 5 o'clock here and I have to go to.
Yeah, Senator Olson.
Thank you. I was pondering through my little brain here about the economics, and you talked about the overall impact of the entire states. And I think that the one thing the Dash 1 doesn't do is take in the employment impacts in the other states when these coal plants close. But the other thing I don't think it takes into account is the fact that not all Oregonians are going to pay for this. Only those customers of PG, Pacific Core, Idaho Power, and those that have coal generation are going to pay, because the other people that get their energy from BPA will not have to pay for this. So I look at it economically as putting a disadvantage to those people that get power from you guys. I hate to say that, but it puts a manufacturing place that costs more for power here right across the street in the CAM Utility Board. It's half the price. And I don't think we've taken that into account of how that impacts the entire state, because we all are not going to pay for it. And I would say, Scott, you had said you have 560,000 customers, and I looked on the map for Varner, and you do Columbia, Washington, Multnomah, Yamhill, Clackamas, Marion, and Polk County. Is that correct?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, we represent 56 cities and 8 counties. Yes.
And as I see that, we have a large portion of the state that is obviously supplied by other entities, and it puts an imbalance in our economics, and that concerns me. I can understand the need to get rid of coal, to phase it out over a long period of time, but as we've banned nuclear, which is a very clean energy, save for the fact that we have the residues, the Navy's used it for years and years and years, we are going to put our state at a real tipping point of economics. And where can you afford to live and where can't you afford to live? Do you have any comments on that?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I think in particular, if you look at the service territory of Pacific Power in Oregon, you see some pockets of the state that are struggling significantly with their local economies. So whether it's rural Lane County or Douglas County or Josephine County, Klamath, you can name quite a few, especially the timber-dependent or resource-dependent parts of the state. Commodity costs, such as electricity costs, are critical to the manufacturing base of those communities. And so, policies that raise costs beyond what they otherwise could be and still meet the same environmental goals are obviously something that's paramount concern to our business and something that, will weigh in vigorously.
Yeah. Follow up. And then
we haven't touched on, and the dash ones, we haven't touched on the new renewable energy credits. Could you explain those and how they work?
Sure. Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, there's a couple deficiencies that we think exist in the dash one. One of which I think is a little bit of a it's a paradigm that I don't think works with what the goal is. If the goal is to reduce emissions, so for instance, the 800 megawatts of new renewables that we've identified in the plan, and these aren't investments that PacifiCorp's making. These are investments that third parties plan to make or are currently making. They have called us up. They have asked us for contracts to sell us that power, and we are planning on that. Those contracts showing up and those electrons to come into our system between now and 2018 or so. That 800 megawatts, we would buy at what's called avoided cost. We would basically buy the cost of our next resource. I know this is a little wonky, but effectively we try to get the best deal we can for our customers. We are under federal obligation, under federal law, to purchase that power. Under this bill, if we don't pay for the renewable energy credit, so basically a derivative attribute of the power, so even though we know it's coming from wind, we know it's coming from solar, if we don't have the title to the paper saying that each unit of production is also renewable, that energy would not count towards meeting the clean energy portfolio in this bill. So even though carbon emissions haven't gone up, even though that power is a specified resource, so we can point exactly where it's coming from, unless we go above and beyond what we would normally be required to pay for that power, it wouldn't count towards meeting our customers' need and the policy goal of, or at least what's on the paper of the dash ones. We think that's a problem. We think that's not very customer friendly. That's a higher cost way to get at the answer than what would be required here. We're also very concerned about language in here that existing resources that we have. So that Leaning Juniper Wind Farm in Gillum County, Oregon, 25% of that's allocated to Oregon today. If for some reason, through negotiation with other states, say Wyoming said, you know what, we're just going to keep all of our coal and continue running those plants. And Oregon, if you don't want to pay for those, that's fine. You can have our share of the wind. That share of that wind plant wouldn't count towards meeting the clean energy standard either. So if we went from 25% ownership to 50% ownership, those additional megawatts wouldn't count. Again, that's borderline punitive to customers. So there's a number of issues just technically within the dash ones that I think missed the mark as far as trying to accomplish a goal of a cleaner energy portfolio, but not really keeping customers in mind and being able to do that in the least cost way or the most efficient way where that investment's already been made. We're just using more of an existing asset.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Senator Dembrough.
Thanks, Ms. Chair. Scott, so, you mentioned that all power plants have end dates, and that includes, all those coal power plants that are out there, and at some point they'll have to be decommissioned or converted. Do you have a sense of what the outside date is? Are you planning for an outside date by which you would be fully transitioned away from coal under the current, sort of risky nature of investing in coal and under those scenarios?
Yeah, Senator Dembrough, it's a great question because it's one of those ones where you know, it's almost like you've got an old car, and you can keep that car running. You can continue to you know, change the oil, really love it, and stretch out the lifespan of that car. And even though it seems like it's getting pretty old, as long as it's still running, you can still use it. At some point, you get to the place where, you know, they just don't even make the parts for that car anymore, or the economics of it's time to get a new car are more appealing than using the old one. And the answer to that question has been pretty theoretical up until recently, because it's such a case-by-case basis, and it's totally dependent on what else is going on in the system. Where else can you get power? What else can you use more? What else should you be using less? And it, up until the 111D rule really came into play, it was a question best answered based on values. You know, should we be reducing carbon, and what's the best way to do that? And if so, how much, and who bears the costs, and, you know, whose local jobs and economies would most be impacted? So there never has been a date certain all these plants will close. What there is by certain dates, the investment that was made in those plants has run out. So at least the people who have invested in the plants no longer have what would, you know, a stranded investment. And at that point, you really are operating just on the cost of gas, if you will, using the car analogy. And at least in that environment, you get to a place where you can make economic decisions without feeling like you're not going to recover your initial investment. Those depreciation lives are basically between early 2030s and mid to late 2040s. That's the window where all the investment in these coal plants is washed out. Now, that doesn't mean that they have to shut down, but it does mean that you can make a different kind of economic decision than you otherwise would, where you might be holding the bag for a bad investment. Now that 111D is in place, it has created a national conversation. So now there's a framework where it isn't a values-based discussion about what should be the end of life date. It really will bring those economics into focus, because you've got to meet targets, you've got deadlines to meet those targets by, and you're starting to weigh those decisions not just on costs, but on where does that get you relative to your environmental goal. And that's where we're at now. So I'm sorry, a terribly long-winded answer, but I personally, I feel like the 111D rule has created more openness in the ability to have these conversations where they're not theoretical, and you're not going to be second-guessed over whether you got your assumptions right or not. Now we know the targets that we're shooting for, and we intend to hit them.
You know, I think that's useful information. And if I could just follow up.
And then we need to move
yes,
on.
Yes, related to a question I asked earlier about the partnerships that are potentially envisioned under the 111D. I mean, does it make sense to be looking at, you know, Oregon partnering with those states that are part of the generating mix of Pacific Power as we're trying to figure out a way to, you know, to reduce everyone's production or consumption?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Denbrough, absolutely. Absolutely it does. Because there are attributes of those states that contribute to Oregon, and Oregon can contribute back. You know, there's a lot of coal in the Powder River Basin in Montana and Wyoming, but there's also a lot of wind. So a lot of the replacement resource, a lot of the opportunities are there. And frankly, you know, we can talk about transitioning off of coal or transitioning the economy. There's only so much Oregon can really do. We don't believe that this approach is that compatible with 111D, because frankly, the real decisions around how to best transition won't happen in Oregon. They will happen in those states. And Oregon having a seat at the table and being able to work with and frankly influence those states is a much better path than going it alone or deciding that, you know, we just don't have enough in common. We have a lot in common and a lot of economic interest to work together.
Thank you both for being here. So I am willing to stay until 5:30. This committee is scheduled to get over, was scheduled to get over normally at a quarter till. We never get over at a quarter till. I'm willing to stay till 5:30 if committee members are. If you're not, if you have to go,
yeah,
and
I'm,
I do
I'm
understand.
I'm already late for another committee.
Okay, then we can do a. We have to open an informational hearing.
The subcommittee.
We have to tap the gavel and everything. We're in a subcommittee. We're in a subcommittee hearing. We'll make it official. And so what we'll do is we've got a panel of three proponents, a panel of three opponents, then two proponents, and then three opponents. So if everybody could keep their testimony like a minute, I know that you'd probably like, I mean, I know people have come here from distance in some cases, but we had a really technical hearing today, and so we had to have time for the exchange and the back and forth. And we will leave the record open for official submissions until 5 p.m. tomorrow if you have something in writing that you'd like to submit. So, Senator Olson, are you able to
I'm here with you.
All right, thank you. So next up we'd have Ann, Garrett, Andy, what's that?
Gravett.
Andy Magi, and Jamie Painter. And I apologize if I did not pronounce your names correctly. And on deck would be Joe Esmond, if he comes back. I saw him leave. J.L. Wilson and John Molas. Go ahead.
Chair Edwards and member of the committee, my name is Ann Gravett. I'm policy advisor to Climate Solutions. We're a regional nonprofit promoting practical solutions to global warming. I will very briefly touch on two points that have been raised today. The first is about EPA's Clean Power Plan. Let me be clear, we could not be happier about EPA issuing its rules this summer. This is the first time the federal government is regulating carbon dioxide emissions. This is progress. And the best thing the state of Oregon can do to prepare for these 111D rules is to begin reducing carbon emissions. This bill is consistent with 111D. We do not need to wait to have a conversation about this bill until after the final rules come out. We can begin to move forward. The bill provides 10-year time window to transition off of coal. This bill is consistent with EPA's Clean Power Plan. Second, I'll just say timing. It is not too late to have this conversation. These are not new concepts. This is not a new conversation. As Jason's presentation indicated, we have been talking about coal in this state for 10 years. We still are reliant on one-third of our power coming from coal and two-thirds in some parts of the state. This is not a new conversation, and there is still time this session to have this conversation about this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards, member of the committee, my name is Andy Magi. I'm the director of the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club, and I'm here today representing over 20,000 members and supporters we have all across Oregon. And to be brief, I really want to hit home the idea that Oregonians overwhelmingly support the idea of transitioning from coal to clean energy. In polling that was conducted in January, 71% of Oregonians that they supported this proposal and want to see legislation pass this session. This is not simply a group of environmentalists. This is a broad coalition. Yesterday, you saw around 200 citizens come into this building in support of this legislation, talking about clean to coal, coal to clean. Not only were we joined by members of the Oregon Conservation Network, but we had public health organizations, doctors, nurses, professors, mothers. Over 300 businesses have signed on to the idea of this transition. And today, if you look in the letters of support, you'll see letters from the mayor of Portland and the commissioners there, and renewable developers from across the state, including our coast. We have a choice to make. We can continue to send about $295 million out of state every year to pay for coal energy, or as Oregonians, we can be clear that we want to invest in local clean energy jobs right here in our own state. And that is all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andy. Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jamie Painter, and I'm here today on behalf of the Union of Concerned Scientists. We know that coal is the dirtiest source of energy. It releases more harmful pollutants into the atmosphere than any other source of energy. We also know that renewable energy is growing rapidly and is already a significant source of electricity here in Oregon. we support policies like this that will help us ramp up our renewable energy use here in Oregon and reduce our dependency on fossil fuels. If possible, there's a physician who I'd like to yield my 30 seconds to, who will be coming in shortly.
Okay. Well, when they get here.
Great. Thanks.
We'll recommend another panel. Thank you each for being here. Next up, so I think that Joe is not here. Mike Fries, you were going to be on a later panel, but do you want to go in Joe's place? And J.L. Wilson and John Molis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, putting on record the comments of the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities and the Northwest Food Processors Association. With regard to ICNU, we have 160 facilities in Oregon employing over 170,000 Oregonians. Both associations have asked me to put for the record that we oppose 477 on the basis of cost and the reliability of energy. And that is, no one has really studied the impact that changing the resource mix could have on the utility's ability to generate and deliver stable and reliable source of energy to our industries that is 90% cleaner than coal, and at what cost. We certainly can't afford shutdowns or loss of production associated with lack of reliable energy. I would also say our industries are bracing for 111D compliance costs, somewhere in the neighborhood of 12% to 17% increase in their energy, and any additional cost and uncertainty stemming from state policy is not welcome at this time. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, Mike Fries, representing AOI. AOI represents approximately 1,500 businesses who employ roughly 200,000 people across the state. As JL put it, we oppose Senate Bill 477 based on a number of factors. One, and probably the largest, is the uncertainty around cost. But shortly behind that is the uncertainty around reliability in the system. There are a number of studies out there across the country, both looking at issues with renewable portfolio standards as those ramp up, as well as how to deal with a new energy mix that's hitting our grid. And many of those do raise significant concerns and questions about not only how to prepare systems for those new energy mixes and increasing energy mix, but also who's going to pay for that. And with the number of industrial members and members that are large energy consumers, we fear that they're going to bear a brunt of a lot of the cost to this legislation, and ultimately either need to move investments elsewhere outside of the state or just simply close their doors. So with those concerns, we oppose Senate Bill 477.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, John Molis, representing the Oregon State Building Trades Council. It's an umbrella organization for about 25,000 union construction workers. And I just got heads up on the Dash Ones this morning, so I'm just going to speak in general to the policy. We heard earlier about the state and federal efforts to reduce carbon, and I think everybody agrees that's the right way to go. I think the question is how fast and how much and what's the cost. Our members love building the renewables, the wind farms, the solar. We want to build wave energy in the future, but we're also very concerned about industry existing in our state. Our industry was 35 to 60% unemployed for about 5 years, and two of the industries that continued to build through the downtime were computer chip manufacturers and data centers, both of which are very energy intensive, and we're very concerned that if prices in this state, you know, double, triple, quadruple, these folks can and do obviously build any place in the world. And we don't want that to happen. We want them to build right here. So I just think we need to look very closely and be very careful of what we're doing. Thank you.
Thank you each. Did you have any questions?
Thanks. We'll get through all these people.
Where was I? Okay. Martin Bonani and Kelly Campbell. Or stand-ins. Oh, you're getting them. Okay.
Martin's on his way.
Okay. You can go ahead and okay. Start.
Okay, great.
My name's Kelly Campbell, and I live in Southeast Portland. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, but my most important job is being a parent, and so I'm here today to speak to you as a mom. My six-year-old son, Finn, is here today as well, and it's because of his future and the future of all the children of Oregon that I urge you to support SB 477. We're already feeling the effects of climate change here in Oregon and around the world. Local impacts include low snowpack, drought, wildfire, air pollution that exacerbates childhood asthma and contributes to neurological damage in children. Coal burning is one of the leading causes of climate change, and fortunately, we have clean energy options that can replace this outdated technology now. When I explained to Finn why we were coming here today, he asked me, "Why do adults still use coal when they know that coal hurts kids?" He insisted that adults should know better, and that it was not fair to kids that we keep burning coal. And it really is that simple. We have a moral obligation to act now and to act boldly to preserve a life-sustaining planet and a clean and green Oregon for our own generation and for those to follow. Just yesterday, we had a Clean Energy Works home audit, including looking at the possibility of solar panels for our house. Families like ours across the state are doing their part to support clean energy and a healthy climate. But the transition from coal to clean isn't going to happen simply because of personal decisions. The switch is only going to happen fast enough to protect a life-sustaining climate for our children because you, our elected leaders, take the common sense actions to lead the way to a clean energy future. As a parent, the future I want for my child is one with a stable climate, clean air and water, good-paying, healthy jobs, and the ability to enjoy the beautiful state of Oregon. The coal to clean energy bill you're considering today is a major step in achieving that vision, and I urge you to support SB 477 and do the right thing for all the children in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Senators. My name is Martin Donahoe. I'm a physician. I'm adjunct faculty at Portland State University in the Masters of Public Health program, author of a textbook in public health, author of over 100 to 150 peer-reviewed articles, many of them covering environmental health. But most important, I'm single father to a delightful 16-month-old who's a little sleep-deprived and cranky, but in general is a very happy child. And it's one of the main reasons I'm here, on my own behalf, on her behalf, and on behalf of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, where I'm a member of the Board of Advisors. Oregon still gets one-third of its energy from burning coal, the largest source of air and carbon pollution in the United States, the leading contributor to climate disruption, and a major public health threat. The consequences of coal burning include increased ground-level ozone, which worsens lung and cardiovascular health, more air pollution, increasing the risk of asthma, heart attacks, strokes, and cancer. In fact, air pollution causes 200,000 premature deaths each year in the United States and 6 million deaths worldwide. Another consequence is exposure to neurotoxic mercury, which impairs fetal and infant brain development, and of course the contribution of burning carbon-based fossil fuels to global warming, which causes 400,000 deaths each year, according to the World Health Organization, and this number is expected to double by 2030. Add into that the weather extremes involving severe, deadly, and costly storms and record-breaking wildfires. The coal cycle carries numerous other health risks, including exposure to coal dust and coal train diesel particulate matter, which can cause lung disease, heart attacks, stroke, and cancer. The dangers to life and health from a changing climate in the Northwest cannot be ignored. Air pollution leads to more emergency room visits, hospitalizations, missed work days, and higher health care costs for families, businesses, and the state. Our clean water supply is shrinking. Our smaller snowpack means less water for irrigation and disruptions in our rural economy and food supply. Clean, renewable energy sources are clearly far better for our health and environment than any fossil fuels, not just coal, but oil and natural gas, which carry their own similar health and environmental risks. The goals of the Coal to Clean Energy Transition Bill are supported by a large majority of Oregonians. The measure is financially sound, it will provide long-term family wage jobs, and it would literally decrease suffering and save lives. Fossil fuels are a dying 19th century technology with Dickensian effects on human health and the environment. Oregon needs a 21st century energy policy. Please pass this bill for the sake of our health, our communities, and all our children. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak before this committee. Thanks.
Thank you both. Question? Thank you both. Next, we have Nancy Baker Croft and Cecilia Craig.
Are you coming, Cecilia?
She crossed my name out. It's fine.
She wanted to testify. She wanted to be here. So
okay.
Am I wrapping up? Is anyone else after me?
Nobody else is signed up. And if there's anybody else that would like to testify, we've got a few more minutes. So
come on down.
For the record, thank you very much for your sponsorship of the bill and also Representative Reed. And for the record also, I'm very disappointed that as a public hearing, 99% of it went to the testimony of those that were not the public. Those people are paid lobbyists, for the most part, are paid state employees, and many of us came today. We're wearing yellow shirts. You know who we are? We're the public. We took the day off work without pay to be here today. Thank you very much for your staying, and also Senator Olson for you staying. I'm Mrs. Baker Croft. I'm a teacher in Salem. In Olympia, Washington. I live in Salem, but I commute to Olympia. So I have been there for the testimony and heard some of the same testimony myself in the Washington legislature, where there's also opposition to similar concerns about changing out of coal. We can't control the other states that have coal. We can only control our own state. And if you look at the externalities of the economics, Mr. Wilson would have you believe that the importance is the economics. Well, the economics is not the only piece, because if we have no planet in 2050, we have no planet B. The cost of solar, the cost of wind, yes, there are certain research and development costs associated, but who pays for those? Seems to be the public's paying for those. However, we are more than paying for the research and development and support of oil and coal and gas. The subsidies that those guys have, they're like welfare mothers, the way they're sucking up the profits, the incredible profits in the oil industry and coal industry. Big coal and big oil, us little people here, us in this state, we're the ones that can say our climate is more important for our children, for the future. And I thank you for your time in taking the big-hearted decision that you can make to help us get rid of the pollutants and have a better, safer future for our children and grandchildren.
Thank you for your testimony and sentiments. Go ahead. Is there anybody else that would like to say a few words? I mean, we have like 2 minutes.
Thank you so very much. My name is Edith Gillis. My father has worked for 45 years for Pacific Power and Light, or Pacific Core. And so I'm, as an engineer, I'm planning with the mix, the development of what they would use for the productivity of electricity and its transmission, as well as the development of the different substations. So let me assure you that having a mix of different power sources is not new. It has always happened, and they have known in the 60s that they were going to get off of coal. They didn't want to be a part of nuke, and they were going to get off of LNG, natural gas. Now, we've been talking about greenhouse gases. Methane gas produces far more difficulty. It heats up the atmosphere much, much worse than carbon dioxide. We're always talking about the risks. The risks involved with carbon, with coal, and with methane or LNG, especially when it's fracked gases. Not only the volatility and unreliability of those products, but it also is increased risk because of the fire, the explosions, the terrorists, the different types of localized or of centralized control, of the lawsuits, of the injuries to workers, and that are not paying their taxes, as well as the cost to the ratepayers, are that a lot of their money is not going to productivity of electricity and the transmission of it or equitable distribution of it, but to lobbying, to getting out of paying their taxes, out of gambling on the stock market, not in giving us the services that we've been paying for. Now, Senator Olson, I lived in Klamath Falls. In the late 1800s, in the early 1900s, we had a very powerful geothermal program. In fact, in the early 1960s, in the early 1970s, there were scientists that risked their livelihoods, their lives, their freedom, and the lives of their family members to come to Klamath Falls to see how we were leading the world in geothermal productivity. We can still do that. We can do a lot more. What makes it have a lot more secure energy base is that we decentralize and we democratize and we diversify our energy production and accessibility, and that we reduce the cost for large production and expensive transmission. We lose most of our energy. It's very inefficient with these large power transmissions. I grew up in rural areas in Oregon, and they're vastly underserved, and they're screwed by Pacific Power and Light. The way we reduce that and we have more security is that we have localized, democratized power with diversified sources. So we have the small power, the small wind, we have the small solar, we have the small geo. Another thing we were talking about is that, as in Portland, Oregon, we have clean turbines that are inside the water system, and we can have those in our sewer systems too. So we're generating electricity without any pollution, without any methane, greenhouse gases. We also have biomass. We also have wave tidal. We have passive solar as well as active solar. Now, in California, we had big, and in the East Coast, we had big rolling blackouts and brownouts. They were not due to insecure or unreliable sources. It was a corporate decision to extort and terrorize the local politicians and ratepayers to raise up the rates. We can avoid that. Now, we also have to learn that, as in Scappoose, we have Ingenuity Innovations, where they are using technology developed by Tesla in the 1800s for what we call free electricity. We can do a lot more to have a lot more diversity, which Pacific Power and Light wanted to do in the 1960s. So we don't have to believe their lies and their nonsense, saying that they don't have enough time to decide this. They were talking about this in the 1960s. They know what to do, and they've always had a mix. They've always been changing it around, and we can do a much better job. Not only do I want us to pass this, but I want us to get rid of natural gas, because that is much more dangerous for us. It's going to lose a lot of jobs. We'll lose our economy if we have any kind of explosions. And we can build our economy by building a lot of small, local, democratized power production where we are. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. That concludes our hearing. We're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 477. We're closing the subcommittee. We're closing the full committee. We're closing the subcommittee. We're closing the full committee.